Hello, and welcome to the Providence College Podcast. My name is Joe Carr. Of all the people who have ever graduated from PC, today's guest has one of the most compelling and inspiring stories. Arn Chorn Pond, class of 1992, was born in Cambodia in 1966. When the Khmer Rouge came to power in 1977, he was taken to a prison camp. When he was just 12, his captives gave him a gun and forced him to fight the Vietnamese. Arn saw violence and death that few of us can imagine, all when he was still a child. He escaped and lived on his own in the jungle for months, finding his way to Thailand, where he was taken in, brought back to health, and given an opportunity to start a new life in the United States.
To begin, I'd like to go back to your early childhood in Cambodia and ask you to tell us about your family and something that would save your life and later influence so much of what you do, and that is, of course, music.
During the Khmer Rouge in 1975, I was grown up in a small province, not too small of a province called Battambang province. It's the second largest province, I think, in terms of geographic situation in Cambodia. Battambang is along the border of Thailand, near Thai border. So when the Khmer Rouge came, in 1975, I was only 12 years old, around there, 11, 12. Right away, I was cheering them like everyone else, thinking that peace would come. But everyone was wrong, obviously. And I had no idea about the political situation, but I was just like everyone else, following everyone else. When they cheered, I cheered. When they say peace is coming, I say the same. And then 3 days later, the Khmer Rouge came to my house, and all of a sudden they chased us out of our home. And I was taken very quickly by the Khmer Rouge with about 700 children to a temple, a Buddhist temple, where they converted into a killing place, where I grew up there for 3.5 years out of four years of the Khmer Rouge killing field. And I was forced to live there for about 3.5 years, and we were forced to live there and work there and die there. And we were not prisoners. We were just children. And we would wake up, like they would wake us up like 5 o'clock in the morning and work until 12 at night. And a lot of time there were no food for us. So the children began to get sick and die. And every day at the temple, they would bring people to come and kill them 3 or 4 times a day. They kill them. Sometimes they kill 1 or 2 people, and sometimes they kill 50 to 100 people. And they also force us to watch the execution. And sometimes they force us to be involved in pushing people into the grave. And they told us that, they said, if you don't work, if you don't follow the Angkor, which is Pol Pot, the leader of the Khmer Rouge, they mentioned the name, we would be killed also. And so at those moments, I was already a year into the temple, living in that temple. And all of a sudden, the Khmer Rouge said to us, we wanted to start a music group. And, you know, I did not know that time if they were tricking us. Because if the Khmer Rouge, if they trick us, we would kill right away if we raise our hand in the wrong time or in the wrong situation. I know that. So I just raised my hand very quickly, and I knew that if I go now, it doesn't matter. But then they didn't trick us. They started a music group which, you know, play and sing their revolutionary songs. They brought a master to come into a temple to teach us about a few hours and a day, and about two or three week, one of my first master was killed, and three boys that raised their hand for music. They were music groups. They were dancers, and three out of five of us also ended up being slaughtered with my teacher. And they brought another teacher to come and taught us. So my second master was Master Mac. His name, Master Mac, he was also as old, not as old as the first one. But then I didn't know what happened after we survived there for four years. And I heard that the Vietnamese in 1979, the Vietnamese invaded Cambodia, and they took my instruments away. They gave me guns, and my teacher sort of prepared me. That was the last time I saw him, prepared me for war, and I couldn't hardly carry the guns. I was very small and very short, and the guns were like bigger than me. And he said, you know, I'm sure we will see each other again. I can look at him in the eyes, but then I was trucked into the front line and joined thousands of other children into the war.
And before this happened in your early childhood, music had been a part of your life, correct? With your parents were involved in the performing arts, and even you performed yourself as a very young child, correct?
I had a year. I was about 9 or 10. I had a year, you know, 1974. That's when I knew that my parents did something with the music or with the arts. They owned up. I found out later, 25 years later, after Providence College, I went back, you know, and they owned up a company, and that was why I felt when I was a little boy, I felt the light on my face. And I was put into on a stage before, but no recollection of dates or anything. I had no idea, and I knew that war started already. I think that I've heard the name between American and Viet Cong, and American and Khmer Rouge, but it doesn't ring. I don't know anything about them, and it doesn't ring a bell during the time. And this is 1974, only for 1 year. And that during that, even that time, there were rock and roll everywhere, you know, like the whole city were like singing. You know, I heard now some of the music were from America. And, you know, I with my little brother were dancing into music. And I remember I loved going to the movie with him, with my little brother, and eating ice cream and I heard already the artillery along, you know, many places around the city, but I didn't care about it. I didn't know what war was like, and I didn't care about it until a year later, 75, when then they said, you know, that the Khmer Rouge came in, there were no more war, and that was it, you know? And then all of a sudden I was put into a killing camp, and I don't know how I survived there either, but, you know, I just take minutes by minutes. Every minute during the Khmer Rouge was like, you know, like life and death situation. You have to really make a quick decision if you want to live.
Let's pick up your story where you left off there. And you were able eventually to escape, and you found your way into the jungle and survived alone for some period of time.
Thousands of children were used as a decoy by the Khmer Rouge, because the Khmer Rouge did not want to have their own soldier got killed before us. So they used children like myself to go into the front line and draw the fire first and got killed first. And I was put into a small platoon to go to go first and probably to get information about where the Vietnamese were, and then got shot first. And in the beginning, for like years, one, three or four, 5 months, we were like face to face fighting with the Vietnamese. We didn't know why the Vietnamese were so good, because they didn't use any plane. They only used tank. If they were using plane, I wouldn't probably be here. I mean, so many children shot and died, and we were used as a decoy to get shot first. And sometimes we were not allowed to, if we didn't have any order from the Khmer Rouge to take off. The Khmer Rouge sometimes shoot us from behind too. So we were used even by the Khmer Rouge, you know? So, like many people were killed in my platoon, that I ended up alone by myself, sometimes weeks, sometimes months. I don't know how long I was there. In the jungle, you know, like a tropical jungle. In tropical jungles, it's really big. And I got lost there and I almost gave up. I don't know, I think many months later, I ended up in the clearing field. You know, I was found by five girls along the border, unconscious. And I got bruised, I got, blisters in my body. And then they saved me. And that's the Thailand, I didn't even know, I didn't realize it was Thailand. You know, I didn't realize that there were another country that speak different language from mine, or that the world, I thought the world was flat, you know? And then that's where I met my father, Peter Pan, my adopted, a man who they call him American. And for the first time, all of these years, I've heard the word American, but I've never met any American until now. I met the white man who later on became my adopted father, and brought me here in 1980. In the fall of 1980, I ended up in New Hampshire.
Reverend Peter Pond, who died 20 years ago, he was a compelling figure, and he devoted much of his ministry to helping children, first in Hungary and later in places like Puerto Rico, parts of Latin America, and of course in Southeast Asia. What was he like, and what was it that compelled him to do what he did?
Later on I got to know him. I think we love each other. I never had a father in my life before. So it was a struggle for me, my dad, and also my mom very much the first 5 years or first 5 to 10 years in America. He was a reverend. He's graduated from Yale University, from Divinity School. He went there just visiting his mom, my grandmother, my adopted grandmother, who was a wife of a former American ambassador to Thailand, and he died there in the 60s, and she ended up living there. So Peter, for the first time in 1979, visited her with Peter Jr., my adopted brother. And he, in 1979, during the time I was just rescued by this four or five refugee girls, and put in the camp. So he went by accident to go to the camp. He heard about the refugee camp, and his mom was very powerful figure. She was very close friend to the Queen of Thailand. So she allowed him to go with Peter Jr. to go visit the camp. So first time, I think when he went there, he saw many, many children. He compared the camp in Thailand like the Nazi, like the Auschwitz camp. So I had no idea before what he said, but now I know. And he saw many children died. And I only remember that they put many people who just came from along the border from the Khmer Rouge, a killing field from inside Cambodia. It just too many of them died. They put them in a big house, in a refrigerator, a big refrigerator. They buried them. They couldn't bury them on time. So, and that I remembered, and I was crawling among the maggots. You know, among the in the dirt, and among other children. And I don't know why he was like, you know, at night they were flooding. And then he couldn't get out of the camp. He just was just there the whole time. And then literally he stepped on me. And I think I was screaming, and I think he saw my teeth. The night was really dark, and he picked me up among many children. I think, I don't know what happened, and then the next day he came back, and he's trying to see me, trying to find me, and finally we found each other. And then he told the people in the camp, I think the doctor in the camp, to really save me. I saw him giving money to them and pointed to me and saying maybe he wants them to save me or something like that. So the doctor, I saw the doctor from the far away. He said, no, this guy would not survive. This kid would not survive. And then I keep crawling, you know, make myself noticeable. Then I said, I'm not going anywhere. And he came to the camp a few times more to see me. And later on, he told me in America, he said, and he never seen anything like that. The suffering, he said, in the camp that you were in. And this is a conversation like 15 years later, or something like that. And in 1980, in the fall, and he got me. It's a long story. While we were in the camp, you know, the Khmer Rouge noticed that we were in the Khmer Rouge camp still. The Khmer Rouge came to the camp and sometime kidnapped children to go back and fight the Vietnamese. And Peter knows that. They wanted to kill Peter too, and Peter Jr. too, because they knew that Peter planned to get us out of the camp. And many times Peter went there with Peter Jr. to go and sleep there, and sleep in the camp, and they were not allowed. And Peter is really daring, you know? And I think one time he came in, and the Khmer Rouge and the Thai army put him in jail and beat him up. So he used that case to go and tell his mom in Bangkok to try to get the queen and his mom to allow him to take us from the refugee camp to America. So he got three of us out. And we found out that three of us were the first children, orphan children, refugee out of Cambodia. We didn't know that in the beginning, but we were the first, because Peter was lucky. He uses his own life to rescue us from the camp. So in 1980, in the fall, we were in New Hampshire. And the next day, the next 2 days, he took us to the mall. And the next 5 days, he took us to high school, White Mountain Regional High School in New Hampshire.
So quite suddenly you find yourself in an English-speaking high school halfway across the world from where you had just been. What a tremendous period of adjustment. How did you manage that?
Barely. I would have been died. Three of us would have been dead out of our anger and guilt and many things inside ourselves that many American children there had no idea where we just came from. They only notice us that we are different. We are Asian, we are different, and the kids began to start picking on us already. And I remembered all I knew was that I got angry every day. I didn't know, I was confused, especially confused and angry. I felt like nobody were on our side. And the kids, you know, like call us monkey, and they physically sometimes we had gone into a fight many times. I broke the school window. We ran away from home a few times and got arrested a few times, and we were so violent. And the first 5 years were almost like a life and death situation for us. I thought we also, you know, got away from that during the Khmer Rouge. But now it's a different thing. You know, it's not a life and death in terms of physical thing, but more mental, more because I'm not sure why, you know, in my body, we always get angry. And I don't really blame them at all, you know, because they had no information about us or anything like that. And Peter was just dropped us there. And he knew that we were facing, especially for me, the two boys were doing okay. But I think we all had the same problem with anger, with guilt. Why I survived many of my brother and sister, two of my little brother and sisters who I saw starve to death during the Khmer Rouge. And I saw, you know, 1,000 people killed. And so maybe those things that really got me angry until today. But nobody knows, nobody understood anything about that, what inside of me, you know. They I saw them very happy, and that's all. And I want to be the same, and I want to be accepted. But I don't know how. And I think Peter, the problem has been like this. Peter, you know, we didn't speak any English. That's a problem. That's the biggest barrier we have to bear. So Peter have asked me later on, he cried. He said, I know he felt that we are really in a very grave situation here. He really plead us to start speaking about the situation where we came from. And I have no idea what speaking about my life was about. But I kind of, you know, I'm very much, I also want to save my life too. I said, if this happened, if this speaking helping to make the children understand, I would do it. So it took me so many years to start doing that. And then not only, you know, speaking, but also eventually I began to start picking up I play the flute now. When I was forced into musician in the Khmer Rouge time, I play other instrument called like something like a dulcimer, many string. You hit it hits by, you know, by like two bamboo sticks, and you hit it with you know, with that instrument. That's how I started. But now in America, I pick up the flutes, easier to bring around. And then you know, when I begin to play the flute more and more and more, and I begin to really connect myself to the music that I play with, and connect myself to my homeland and all of that. And you know, I with the sound of the flute that I learn, I can control my anger. I feel like I can use every time I play that flute. I was literally calmed down, you know, because every time when I share my story, I shook. And my stomach hurts, my head hurts, even now, I'm telling you. I don't know when it's gonna go away, but I think it's you know, I think it's natural. When you say something important, when you say something that connect to your life, and especially a painful memory and all that, and I begin to understand that. And with American kids too, I told them, you know, please, I don't make fun of other people, and because of my skin, because I look different, and you know, we cry the same, we suffer the same, we feel the loss the same, we eat the same thing. So all of these things come into my head, you know. I keep speaking to them about different things that usually I started with the learning from by heart. But a few words, memorizing what my dad told me. And then I began to write my own speech. And then I gave up the speech because I start talking to them, making different points. And then like talking to you now, sometimes I don't make sense. You know, I speak English like I, I 11-year-old kid speaking, you know, but it's okay. That's the reality for me. I do it, you know. So whenever I speak about the experience, I go back when I was 11 or 12 years old, automatically like that. So I can't control it. So I don't know. I don't know whether you understand what I'm saying now.
I think you're a tremendous communicator, Arne, and we're hanging on every word of your fascinating story. Incidentally, if any of our listeners are interested in hearing you play music, there are some really good online videos, especially one from a TEDx talk that you gave at a university in England, where at the end you play a beautiful tune on the flute. So that's worth checking out if you'd like to hear Arne tell more of his own story and to actually hear him play music, which he does so beautifully. That part of your story is so incredible, Arne, where you picked up the public speaking and you found your way using music and also your ability to play soccer. You became an excellent high school soccer player and led your teams to some great successes in high school. So you found a way to acclimate, and then you made your way to Providence College. Tell us how you got from New Hampshire to PC.
I was at Brown first, at Brown University nearby, and never, you know, it took me 7 years of high school, like four or five different schools. I went to Gould Academy, Northfield, Mount Hermon, because of my English. But I was already on the roll of my speaking around America between college and I think between high school and college. I was asked already in many places like around America, you know, to speak about Cambodia. They've never heard anybody speak about the killing field, in the worst, probably one of the worst genocide in the 20th century. So even though my English was not that good, but I tried very hard. I spoke at one place called the Carter Center. And after I spoke there, there was a man who really, you know, like tears in his eyes, and he came and hugged me and he said, "I'm sorry, Arne, what had happened to your family and happened to your country, and the loss you had and the pain you go through." And I can see he's very sincere, but I hugged him back and I told him, you know, it's okay, you're not responsible for it, you know, I thank him for listening to me, and he cried, and I cried. I saw him crying, and he said, "No, I should be responsible, because you know, I was a former president of the United States. Jimmy Carter was nearby me, and we had took a picture together." And I said, "Wow, you should be responsible then. Why didn't you know anything about Cambodia?" He said, "I knew, but I knew not so much. You know, that was my fault." But at least he admitted it, that he said, you know, "I have the whole world in my shoulder, and Cambodia would just happen in very secret, you know." But I you know, we hugged each other, and they said, "Where are you now?" He got, you know, and he said, "You want you to go to college?" I said, "Yes." He said, so he wrote me a recommendation to go to Brown University with his daughter, Amy Carter. We went at the same years. But he said, you know, my recommendation is just helpful, but no guarantee, you know. Then I went to a few other high school to get my English polish, and Northfield Mount Hermon for 1 or 2 years there helps me a lot. So they I think they even make a recommendation from Jimmy Carter. They really look at me in the eye and say, "Arne, we will accept you, but you must promise us not to go and speak anywhere anymore." They knew that I have to focus in school, not to go and speak different places. I don't have time to go out I have to, you know, work really hard at Brown. And I at that time, I had to continue my speaking because speaking, some people think it's not a good idea for me to go, but it helps me a lot, you know, it continue to, because I can express myself. I can play my flute to the to young people and get my story across. I now not only speaking and playing, but I begin to make money now. You know, the young people give me money and I save all the money. I raise some money in school. When I spoke at Brown University, after the speaking, I raised some money and I saved it. And I knew that, you know, I will not get away from my dreams. Probably I have to come back to Cambodia. To really face my past, if I really want to put things behind, I have to really confront it. Like what I'm doing with the speaking engagement, you know, it later on heals me, and for the first time, I can play my music again, and also I learn eventually how to cry for the first time in my life, and that helps me a lot, learning how to cry, you know. And learning how to listen to my own feeling when I speak about it, you know, and that helps me a lot, to heal me a lot. People think that do not work for some people. They don't want to confront what they have been through. So I think furthermore, I have to come back. I knew that I have to come back to Cambodia someday. So I save all the money and I raise all the money, and eventually I came back. I left Brown because I felt lost there. It's just so big. So I applied. In fact, I applied to Providence College. And I think there's the only one presidential scholarship. And I went there. I was so nervous. They said, you know, the only one presidential scholarship. So they said, you get it, Aaron. And this guy wants to see you at his office. So I went to see him, who is Father Cunningham, when he was at Providence College. And he was a father, and he was the president of the college. And he also looked at me in the eye and said, Aunt, this is only one presidential scholarship that I give to you. Again, I want you to succeed, and I want you to just focus in school. He acted like I'm his son and his grandson. He said, "Aunt, you didn't know, but you don't know that I know about your story and all these things." But he said, "I read few things about you. That's why I give you this scholarship, and it's special to me personally." He said, "What you've been through." And during that time, I remembered in the whole college, there were not very, very few Asian from all over the world, very few. Maybe non-Southeast Asian, like from Cambodia, from Laos, from Burma, there almost none. When he took me and he assigned me to for a few people to help me, these people who really become close to my life also, like Judy Jameson, who is a dean of, we still a good friend even now, look after me and make sure I stay at home. I stay at the dorm after the curfew at 10 o'clock, not going out speaking in New York or in different places. And I was able to survive. I know nothing about, you know, the institutions, but they said on that institution, you know, Providence College is very strict. All I knew was that during the time they had a very good basketball team, you know. They're very famous in basketball team. So that's all I know. They said Father is very, he's very strict. They said Catholic Church is very strict. I said, no, he's not that strict with me. He's very caring. He said, why you say that? Many people scared of him. I said, no, he's a very nice man, you know. and then, you know, after that, they say the institution also very strict. But I go there after a year or so. When I go visit him from time to time, I bought food for him and all that. And he sit me down and he said, how's school and all these things. And then, you know, I said, I said, why you ask me to take, Western Civ? Like Western Civ, there are like five courses in that one class. I barely survived it. And I said, why don't you teach Eastern Civ in your school? Why don't you, why only I take Western Civ? You know, now I have few friends now who you accepted to Providence College. Now we have enough Southeast Asian. Why can't we have some Buddhist teaching or something like that, Eastern Civ or something like that? I was just saying that. And he said, Ann, you're probably right. And so Judy Jamison also agreed to do this. For the very first time, I was there for 1 year. There was a Western Eastern Civ class taught in that Catholic institution. They said, "Aren't you don't know how strict they are." So there's something there that these two people, like Father Cunningham, really, he inspired me. He gave me a lot of hope. I went back a few times to see Judy Jamison and to go to see him. I think I saw him the last time a few weeks before he died. And, you know, people don't know him. And I think like a lot of people who don't know me, you know, they think I'm different, and they think they get angry at me and they judge me. The same way with my father, the same way with Father Cunningham, you know, and when they learn something, they accept something, they do it, you know, they do it. And they're willing to open their heart for a few things. Like I went to his room after he died, and I wasn't there when he died, Judy told me. And then I saw an article on his desk in a New York Times about me, and about about me and how I entered Providence College, New York Times that he saved. So they are inspire me. These two people, or three people, that even Father Cunningham, people judge him, and my father. My adopted father, and many people that we all judge, we all put in the on the cross. So, you know, he asked me whether I'm Buddhist or not, Father Cunningham. I said I was my parents raised as Buddhist. I lived in, I was born in a Buddhist country, and I came here. I went to the church with my adopted father, and. I go to the church in school in Providence College. So we pray a few times, just him and me at the church in Providence. So something like this, nobody knew. Nobody in the school knew. Maybe Judy Jamison knew. So I'm hurt a little bit, but I miss him. I miss my father and my Father Cunningham.
You know, establishing the relationship with you and others, that's a big part of Father Cunningham's legacy. In fact, to this day, the college has the Cunningham Scholarship, which was established by Father Cunningham in 1985, and it assists undergraduate Southeast Asian students who reside in the Greater Providence area. So this is something that was important to him, and that work continues to this day, assisting really good students and really helping to enhance our community and to do things to help capable students find their way to a Providence College education. You know, your story reminds me of a great line attributed to another beloved Dominican, Father Robert Morris. He said many times that God sends people to Providence College when it's their time. So that seems like that's what happened with you too, and it's a lovely story. We appreciate you sharing it with us. I'd like to talk a bit, Arne, about your work now in Cambodia and with the music and the arts, the program that has come to be known as Cambodian Living Arts, an organization that you started to revive the traditional performing arts in Cambodia. What is it that motivates you in this work, and what is the impact of it?
That's what I really want, to connect to people and make people understand how I really feel inside, even though I look different. And that's all I want to do in my life. And that's probably the factors that made me survive, you know, that I was willing to even face my own past. I don't want to be, I mean, I cannot share away my nightmares that I dreamed. I'm the only one who will dream it. And if I want to get rid of it, I have to do the opposite. Which is, if I want to get rid of my bad my nightmares, I have to do good. So I never thought that would come across my mind about really the sound of the flute. You know, it transcends. It just I can control myself. I mean, my anger. I can put my feet on the ground very firmly when I feel like I want to swear, or I feel like I want to punch somebody, or I think about getting revenge. I still have all of that feeling, even though I have no enemy. I have no enemy's face or anybody's who I want to really a particular face that I want to punch, or a particular Khmer Rouge face that I want to kill. But it's all still inside of me. But every time I play the flute and much of the music of my country from the past, you know, the traditional music and art in my country here, really when it connects me to my past, and it connects me to the glory, you know, of the peaceful past of my country, connecting me especially to my own family. You remember in the beginning, you know, my parents owned an opera company, and I now begin to connect why I survived during the Khmer Rouge and why I was so smarter than those kids. And if I wasn't smarter than those kids, I would have been killed. And then I began to believe that my teacher, my second teacher, Master Mike, was right, that I was smart, you know, that I had a talent. And I began to believe that. And even now, it take 25 years to start beginning to believe that I was that kid that he mentioned. So I started something, you know, I started in Lowell. In the 90s, when I still worked with the gang members, and using a place where those gang members can come to a center where I found a master musician, a Cambodian refugee's old man, like my master in the past. I brought him Master Bin Pan, who I found out that he know how to play the fiddle, and he had nothing to do at his home, and nobody, you know, take him around or anything like that. I ask him if I can pay him a little and bring him to the center and teach those gang members how to play the fiddle. And that's how we began. Over a few months, those young people began to really, you know, first they make fun of the masters. and the master was really pissed, and I have to be, a mediator of that, and that was my job. And then I just asked them to really, really listen to the master, even though this music is stranger to them, because most of those kids grown up in the street of America, they were also one thing that I feel very similar to what I went through in my life. All over my life is the isolation, the feeling of rejection, the feeling of making fun of. And that's why they were ended up on the street for the first time, in the first place, you know. And the sense of no identity, the sense of no culture, which place I belong to, which country I belong to, you know, those sense of loss I feel. So with those gang members, eventually, they began to the master and those students began to work together. They start teaching the master how to rap, And then the masters happy, and then they began like they start asking the master about how they met, how he's met his wife's in America, how he learned how to play the instruments, and the eventually slowly the friendship began to build, you know, and many of them got out of the street, and they still have connection, they still have this relationship until now. I'm still connecting to them. I'm still communicating with the Master Bin Pan, also Dai now in law, and old age, and you know, and many of his students that he helped. Some of them even went to go to college from the street to go to college. I think music somehow helped to build the platform for the relationship to start, and I think this model helps me when I first time went back to Cambodia in the 90s, in the late 90s. And when I went back using the money I saved from the speaking, I went for the first time in 96, 97. Almost everybody knew my dad by name, know my real mom by name, who owned this opera company. And they knew what he likes to eat. They knew what he likes to perform. He knew what song he liked to sing. I wish I could know that, you know. And I found out during the time too in Battambang that 90% of all the performer, of all the artists died during the Khmer Rouge. And I found out that also my own, I had about like 35 of my own, family, immediate members of my family have died and killed, like everyone else. And I found out 2 million people were killed during the time. This is 1997, right before I went back the next year, starting something called the Cambodian Master Performer Program, which I invited Master Mac. I respect him, invite him, and I found another master who faced the same thing. I used to hear her on the radio in 1974 all the time, squeaky voice singing opera song on the radio, and she survived Master Cheikh Mak. She was the one of the greatest of the you know, opera, like my mom, like my parents, but my parents was younger than her. She was like ultimate. So few masters like that, I found about 5 or 6 masters of musicians. That's how I began Cambodian Living Art in 1998. And then now turned, you know, it evolved into Cambodian Living Arts a little later on.
It's a fascinating organization. And by the way, the website is beautifully done. If anybody would like to check it out and learn more about Arn's work and that of his colleagues, the URL is CambodianLivingArts.org. Also ways to support the work available through that website too. So congratulations on that, Arn, and all the good work that's come from that and that will come from it in the future. Just a few more minutes of your time, if you don't mind. You've been very generous with it today, and we appreciate that. So we've established that you're in Cambodia. What's it like there right now with respect to the coronavirus and the ways that that people are making their way through day to day?
You know, I also think about the people in America now. I am Cambodian Americans, and I happen to get stuck here, but it's fine. Anywhere is my home now. I feel belong to everywhere now. I know better now that everywhere is your brother and sisters, everywhere is your adopted families. The world is my family now. That's what I learned from Father Cunningham and my father, Peter Pan, and a few people in my life. And now we are still using the arts. You know, we are helping thousands of Cambodians now through music, but not only music now, we have cross, like, arts in general. Now we have Arn Chon Phon Scholarship, we have fellowship, we have the first Khmer Magic Music Bus, who I spend most of my time with, now playing and reintroducing traditional music to the countryside, remote countryside, you know, after 30 years, 40 years of war and culminating in the killing fields. And we took the music with the 25-passenger bus, the first 25-passenger bus in Cambodia, to go to the countryside and play for free. I found out that many, many children, especially almost all children, never heard live music in their lives, never touched any instruments, still in the rice field, in the jungle. And it took my breath away. And I feel like, oh my God, you know, in America, I love hearing different kind of music, and everywhere you can go and buy music and all of that. And I almost take things for granted myself. Ice cream everywhere in the mall and all these things, but I almost forgotten that, you know, in Cambodia, my Lord, the older people, something I continue to find out that, you know, when they hear music, especially my flute also, they hear other different kind of form of music. It just don't know what happened. Many of them came out and cried. They cried sometimes, it's like uncontrolled, sometimes like very awkward how they cry, like a little children. They came and I asked them why they behave this way like crazy. They said, "Aunt, you don't know how this music touched me." Many of them said, I've never hoped that I would hear this kind of music again before I die. That's how powerful the music are, reminding them of their past, of their loved ones, of their own culture. It's connect them that nothing else more. I'm learning this every day. That's why I'm speaking it. I'm on my own. And because I began to also feel it. The music is a natural ground. It's the music is like what human need to continue to do, be an artist, be music, giving free music, you know, free. It's supposed to be free for all soul. You know, in Cambodia, we have like when we were born, like when we were babies, there were music, there were like lullabies, and then there were, and I found out that when I travel around the world playing my music for people around the world, there were lullabies every country, like lullabies every culture. So this is a common theme. We have to come together with that common theme of harmony, of common sense of peace through music and all of this. So that's how powerful the music is. It's a very medium. Even politicians, you know, they come and listen. And when they listen to this, they said, you know, we don't see each other. Like, I don't feel like we are enemies anymore. I heard it from the ex-Khmer Rouge soldier when we perform on a mountain for them. You know, I've heard this from them. So at least for 5 minutes, for 10 minutes, when we play for there for half an hour. So it's they surrender their hatred. They surrender their anger. So I'm glad I started Cambodian Living Art using, you know, now people use different kind of form to even heal themselves. So music is all good all around. It's more important than creating jobs or it helps our soul. It heals our soul. And that's how we are still doing this, even during the bad time now, even now. This is for the first time many young people in Cambodia, and I'm sure many young people in the mall of Rhode Island that I work with, many of my friends, my nephew, my niece in Providence, Rhode Island, and in Italy for the first time, they felt like human can die anytime. Life, you know, dying is reality. You know, they feel the first time in their lives that you can die. You know, the school shooting may be not enough to wake the young people up. You know, they make themselves numb like I did. You know, they only want to go to the mall. They take everything for granted. We keep telling them that dying is real everywhere, in different situation, in different suffering, and all of that. And so don't judge people who survive and you know, befriend, be take them in and treat them like what they, you want to be treated. So this is, I feel, for the first time, the young people here, the children here, also like many other places around the world, that death is real for them. So what can we do to help? We cannot do anything. All of us in the same situation. The president feeling the same situation. The king, the queen dies. And nobody invulnerable to this. So who help who? We can. By doing this, by from our, you know, we have technology to help us, like what we are doing now. Continue to learn from each other and share the story, inspiring story that, you know, that the killing field ends. Whoever survived will share the story and listen to their survival story. And you will ask the same thing for the next generation to listen, to pay attention to your survival story. That's our story. It's ongoing. This is a time for us to also reflect on our lives about what you as a person do to help your parent, to tell them that you love them. They give you life. The country that you grew up with, the world that you live on every day, what's important for you, what's important in your life. Some people might continue to say the mall, the ice cream, or the movie. Some people say music, or whatever. I think it's time for us to reflect on what really means to us, what really important priority for us. It's something, it's good for our soul, even though, and I pray like everyone else for this to pass quickly, for this terrible time to pass quickly. But it's time for us to reflect in our lives now, and to be kind to each other, to be united with each other, and to treat each other well. I wish everybody peace and saved and be cleansed and hope this terrible time will pass.
That's our conversation with Arn Chorn Pond, and we hope you enjoyed it. You heard him say how important it is for us to share our stories, and we appreciate him sharing his, remarkable and inspiring as it is. You can subscribe to the Providence College podcast in all the usual places, and they're available on the college's YouTube channel. Feedback is welcome at podcast@providence.edu. Thanks to our producer, Chris Judge. I'm Joe Carr. Until next time.